Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, the great multitude which no man could number. And it's important to put into perspective here that every once in a while, the Lord drops into the record of the book of Revelation a chapter of hope. We have one here in chapter 7, we have one again in chapter 14, we'll have one again in chapter 21, going on through chapter 22. About every third of the way through the book, we have this dropped in. Here we have the sealing of the servants of God. The Apostle Paul said in the first chapter of the Ephesian letter that you were sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise. When God looks at you, he sees that sealing. Back of the, we were talking over at Matt's and Veronica's just a little while ago about Matt used to be in the logging business, and he would take these trees and haul them to the sawmill. But prior to the time that they had large trucks like Matt used to drive to the sawmill, they would just roll or slide the logs down the hill into the river. And then everybody's logs would go down the same river to the same sawmill. You'd have several logging companies working in the same hills. And in order to keep the logs separate from each other, before they slid the log into the river, they would stamp the insignia of that particular company into the butt end of the log, and all the logs went down the river together, and when they got to the sawmill, they would be sorted out according to the seal that had been placed into the end of that log. And when the Father seals us with the Holy Spirit of promise, he's able to see this. It's invisible to human eyes, but he's able to see this. That's the idea here. Back in the 9th and 10th chapters of the book of Ezekiel, we saw that right before the destruction of Jerusalem, God emblematically sealed his people. And he was going to take a special care of them. Now that did not mean that when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians that the people of God weren't killed. It means that even if they were killed, God still took care of them. And the same is true here. The city of Rome is about to be taken over. But prior to that time, God is symbolically sealing his servants, and that doesn't mean that his servants aren't going to be killed, but it means that even if they are killed, the foundation of God standeth sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his. So chapter 7 is a little interim before these four destructive influences or winds are turned loose by the four angels that are holding them back. We've seen a crowd of 144,000 of the 12 tribes of Israel. We've seen a great multitude of every nation, kindred, people, and tongue in verse 9. And these are probably the saints who are sealed unto God by about the year 400 A.D., perhaps, if we place this chronologically. I'll continue on with verse 10. After he sees this great multitude that have white robes and palms, victory in their hands, they cried with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb." And all the angels stood round about the throne, and about the elders and the four living creatures, and fell before the throne on their faces, and worshipped God, saying, "Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be unto our God forever and ever." Seven things mentioned in verse 12. "For unto our God forever and ever. Amen." And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they?" And I said unto him, "Sir, thou knowest." And he said unto me, "These are they which came out of great tribulation." Now last night, I don't have on the board anymore, but last night I had the 10 great general waves of persecution on the board. It was from the top of the board down near the bottom of the board, starting with Nero and ending with Diocletian. The night before we had mentioned those, but last night they were on the board throughout the duration of our class. And I think that's what he's talking about here. These are they which have come out of the great tribulation of pagan Roman persecution. Now I stress that because one of the hallmarks of the modern futurist view of the book of Revelation is that there is a great tribulation yet to come. And this is often spoken of in a very emphatic way. And this scripture is mentioned with regard to that. But here we're talking about a great tribulation, I believe, that transpired in the first three centuries of the Christian era. These are they, this great multitude of every nation, kindred, tribe, and tongue, and the tribes of Israel, they have come out and through the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now that shows that that's symbolic, because if you use literal blood, they wouldn't be white. But they're made white, pure, and victorious in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them and shall lead them unto fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. What a beautiful picture we have here in this latter part of the seventh chapter of the book of Revelation, talking about the wonderful future of the people who remain with the Lord. John heard about them in verse 4. He saw them in verse 9. The martyrs that were given white robes, clothed with white robes. They credit their salvation to God and the Lamb. These are they that came safely through the pagan Roman persecution as God looks at it. That means they didn't recant. They were faithful unto death. So even if they were killed for their faith, as God sees it, they came safely through that persecution. Sometimes maybe you and I look at physical death a little differently than God does. Interestingly, in verse 17, the Lamb becomes the shepherd. And it's entirely appropriate that he should so become. Now this has all been under the sixth seal. These winds have been held back, but they're wanting to blow. Anybody got anything to say over chapter 7 before we go on?
What's the significance of the palm?
The palms seem to indicate victory. Wherever we find them, they seem to be a sign of victory. And they've been used as this for a symbol from very ancient times. Yes, Kevin.
The question that's kind of on my mind is still in the future at this point was the Inquisition, some things of,
yes,
of the next few hundred years.
Yes.
You don't see that as being a part of this,
no,
this group that would be...
No, I don't see that as being a part of this group. Now, when we get to chapter 14, I'll see it as being a part of that group. Chapter 14 comes right after the famous Mark of the Beast at the end of chapter 13. And I think then the fellow servants that were spoken of under the in chapter 6, verse 11, that they should rest yet a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. That may be what's being fulfilled in chapter 14.
That was kind of what I,
yeah,
that had been mentioned in the fifth seal.
So. Yes, very good. Thank you. Good questions. Anybody else have a question or thought up through chapter 7 before we continue? All right. Finally, we get to the seventh seal in the first verse of chapter 8. And this is the last seal on a book of seven seals. This is the last one to be opened. But it's really interesting what happens when he opens this up. Seven is the number, as we've seen several times, of completion, maturity, perfection, or wholeness. Three is the number of God. God is Father, Word, and Spirit. Four is the number of the earth. There are four corners of the earth, chapter 7, verse 1. There are four quarters of the earth. We have that several times in the Bible. There are four main directions on earth, north, south, east, and west. We could probably think of several things that are complete in four on the earth. So three is the number of God, and four is the number of the earth. And when we add those together, often we find that we have God's dealings with the earth, God's dealings with the world. So we're coming right to the end of this seventh seal here, and as far as any creature knew, this seal was going to reveal everything that was left to be revealed. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Now this is silence in contrast to the loud song of praise that was just heard as recorded in the seventh chapter. Kind of reminds me of that novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, as in the calm before a storm. These four winds are being held back. Everybody knows they're soon to be released, and there's going to be something dramatic happen. So here we have silence about the space of half an hour. I think that about is a little bit important. They're showing that this is an indefinite period of time. It's an indefinite and brief delay, so that the Christian faith could become a solid force in the Roman Empire as these four destructive angels are holding back the winds, restraining four destroying powers. All heaven is breathlessly waiting the development. When these winds blow, Rome is going to be obliterated as a world power. In the north, there are gathering forces. Horde after horde of reckless, lawless barbarians are becoming believers in Christ. We're about to see the fall of a third part of the Roman Empire, the western part of the empire, the kingdom of the Franks, as it's sometimes called. Verse 2, "And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets." Now there's an interesting thing. We open the final seal, and it's supposed to reveal everything that is remaining to be told, and suddenly you see seven trumpets. And so it's not a series of infinite regression, but yet it's more complicated than it might at first have appeared. The Jews believed that there were seven archangels, and they had them all named, although the names vary according to the source that you use from Jewish sources. The Bible only speaks about one archangel and calls him Michael. The only other angel named in the Bible is Gabriel, but he's never called an archangel. So just who or what these seven angels are, I don't know any more than what is said here. But they are these seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. So the Apostle John here sees seven trumpets. Trumpets were used to sound the charge of armies, and that's probably the reason that they're used here. In verse 3, we see that another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints. We already saw back in an earlier chapter that incense was symbolic of the prayers of the saints. The prayers of the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne, and the smoke of the incense which came up with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer, which was used for carrying incense, and filled it with the fire of the altar and cast it to the earth. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings and an earthquake. The prayers of God's people keep on ascending no matter what. One thing that we can always do is pray, even if we're relatively helpless in other areas. The story is told of Brother Bill Hensley that one time he went to visit someone who was confined to bed and couldn't even get up anymore, was in a very weakened condition, and they said, "I don't even know why I'm alive anymore. There's nothing that I can do." And Brother Bill said, "No, that's not right. You can always pray, and there are a lot of people who need your prayers." And that's absolutely right. While there is life, there's still the ability for us to do something, even if it's, as we might say, only to pray. The prayers of the saints avail a great deal more than they're often given credit for. Now remember, as we view verse 5 here, that in Ezekiel 10, an angel took the coals. We didn't go back and study Ezekiel 9 and 10 as much as we would if we were being more thorough. But I hope you're familiar with that story. Back there, an angel, after this marking was done in chapter 9, and the marking of the sealing of those people in Jerusalem, an angel took the coals and scattered them over the city of Jerusalem, which was emblematic of making a sacrifice of the city of Jerusalem, just right before it was destroyed by the Babylonians. God was going to make a sacrifice of Jerusalem, and that's what those coals were all about. And now, he's going to make a sacrifice of Rome, and so we have the same symbolism here. Down in verse 6, we see that the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. This is a tension-building verse here, that there's been silence, there is time going by, and there's preparation occurring. We're almost in slow motion here as the trumpet begins to come up to the lips of that first angel. And finally, in verse 7, the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And a third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Now, that's the first trumpet. When we had the seventh seal opened, instead of just being something definitive like these other matters, we see seven trumpets. And so when that seventh seal is opened, then it opens on to this, the seven trumpets, and we have more material to go through than it might have appeared that we would. This first trumpet, I am going to postulate to you and then try to tell you the reason why, is going to represent the Gothic invasion of Rome. And I'm going to place a man's name here. His name is Alaric.
more about him shortly. Alaric and the Goths. And I'll just go ahead while I'm here and put the year 410 A.D. because that's a very important year.
Let me just read to you a bit from Edward Gibbon. I didn't read you any from Gibbon last night. I don't know if you noticed that or not. I read one passage from Will Durant. But I don't think I read anything from Gibbon last night. But since we're looking directly now at the blowing of a trumpet, I'd like to read to you just a little bit from Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Modern Library Edition, page 112. And I'm not going to read everything that's there, but just a few things that are said. Page 112 and 113. The correspondence of nations was in that age so imperfect and precarious that the revolutions of the north, in other words, these barbarians that were gathering in the north, Rome was down in south, in Italy, the revolutions of the north might escape the knowledge of the court of Ravenna till the dark cloud which was collected along the coast of the Baltic burst in thunder upon the banks of the upper Danube. Such was the feeble and exhausted state of the empire that it was impossible to restore the fortifications of the Danube or to prevent by a vigorous effort the invasion of the Germans. Go on down a little bit further. The king of the Confederate Germans passed without resistance the Alps, the Po, and the Apennine. And then on down a little bit further, as they come into Italy, many cities in Italy were pillaged or destroyed. And a little, skipping over a little more, just for the sake of simplicity, the Senate, that's the Roman Senate, and the people trembled at the approach of these barbarians within 180 miles of Rome. And they anxiously compared the danger which they had escaped with the new perils to which they were exposed. So this is as the Goths are coming, creeping, encroaching closer and closer and closer to Rome. Now I'm going to skip 40 pages or so here and go on over to page 152. And here we, Alaric had already been spoken of back there previously, but I haven't mentioned him yet in the account. They came up to the city of Rome itself. Now, the Goths first besieged the city of Rome in 408 A.D., but they were bought off by a large ransom. The second siege by the Goths of the city of Rome was in 409, but once again they were bought off. Finally, in 410 A.D., we find this occurrence. Alaric encompassed the walls, commanded the 12 principal gates. And then further down on page 152, that unfortunate city, speaking of Rome, gradually experienced the distress of scarcity. The reason is that the food supply had all been cut off now. They gradually experienced the distress of scarcity and at length the horrid calamities of famine. The daily allowance of 3 pounds of bread was reduced to one half, to one third, and then to nothing. And then he says on page 153 that a dark suspicion was entertained that some desperate wretches fed on the bodies of their fellow creatures whom they had secretly murdered. And even mothers, such was the horrible conflict of the two most powerful instincts implanted by nature in the human breast, even mothers are said to have tasted the flesh of their slaughtered infants. Many thousands of the inhabitants of Rome expired in their houses or in the streets for want of sustenance. And as the public sepulchres without the walls were in the power of the enemy, the stench which arose from so many putrid and unburied carcasses infected the air, and the miseries of famine were succeeded and aggravated by the contagion of a pestilential disease. This is happening in the city of Rome in 410 A.D. In 410 A.D., after 800 years without being sacked. The last time the city of Rome had been sacked was by the Gauls in 390 B.C., Now we're talking 410 A.D., 800 years without being sacked in all that time. By the way, records about the city of Rome before 390 B.C. are suspect because the Gauls destroyed everything in 390 B.C., burned all the public records, so we really don't know. When you hear about the foundation of Rome in 753 B.C., for example, that's tradition and it's sort of legend, but we really don't know because it's prior to 390 B.C. They'd gone 800 years without being sacked, and now, let me go a little bit further in Gibbon, and this time from page 163. I'm careful to tell you that it's the Modern Library edition because if I just say Gibbon, there's been how many editions of Gibbon? And one of the problems Brother Brumback had in his excellent History of the Church of the Ages, History of the Church Through the Ages, was that he had these books in his library, and if he was quoting Neander, he would tell you what page it was on in Neander and what volume, but it was the edition that he had. He didn't tell you what edition he had. So I've had to look through various editions to find out what page Brother Brumback was actually looking at in the editions that I had.
What volume are you reading?
This is Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Yes. Yes, probably all this will be from Volume 2. And this is the Modern Library edition, which is a three-volume edition that combines 1 and 2 into one volume. And then originally it came out in six volumes. But you can get it in eight-volume sets. And in fact, the little place here on Highway 14, I was in there on Monday, they had it in an eight-volume set, and they had it in a three-volume set. Everything in the store was 40% off. So
They don't have the three anymore,
but they got the eight. Somebody else has been there, too. And by the way, those Will Durant books, I read to you from one last night at the library across the street. I was also there Monday at their sale, and they were selling Will Durant volumes for $1 a piece. And these are big books, you know. Like this is Volume 4, The Age of Faith. They were selling things like that for $1. But now, if they're still there, they're 50 cents a piece because today it went down and tomorrow it'll be down. And if you wait till Saturday, you can have a whole sack of books for a few pennies. So, but I don't know what'll be left by then. But anyway, if you have an interest in that, you should know that those are available right here in town. This is page 163 of the Modern Library edition of Edward Gibbon's work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, on the subject of Alaric and the Goths. The king of the Goths, who no longer dissembled his appetite for plunder and revenge, appeared in arms under the walls of the capital, and the trembling Senate, without any hopes of relief, prepared by a desperate resistance to delay the ruin of their country. But they were unable to guard against the secret conspiracy of their slaves and domestics. You know, I'll just pause to say that there never has been a group of people who enslaved another group of people whose offspring did not someday live in mortal terror of the offspring of those slaves. It happened in Egypt in the days of the children of Israel. Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph and said, "These people, if they're left alone, they'll one of these days join with our enemies and they'll overcome us." It happened in our country. We still have these racial issues all the time. Just when you think they're settled, they're not settled at all. And it happened here. They had many slaves, but the slaves were on the side of the enemy, and it made a big difference. The conspiracy of their slaves and domestics, who either from birth or from interest were attached to the cause of the enemy. At the hour of midnight, the Salarian gate was silently opened so the enemy can enter in. And the inhabitants were awakened. Listen to this. The inhabitants were awakened by the tremendous sound of the Gothic trumpet. Did you hear this agnostic historian talk about a Gothic trumpet? That's the very first trumpet that we're talking about in the eighth chapter of the book of Revelation. It's such a tight fulfillment that it almost makes goose pimples run up and down my spine. Gibbon goes on to say, 1,163 years after the foundation of Rome, the imperial city, which had subdued and civilized so considerable a portion of mankind, was delivered to the licentious fury of the tribes of Germany and Scythia. Gibbon said that blood and conflagration and the burning of trees and herbage, which goes right along with what we read here in verse 7, the third part of the trees were burnt up because this is a third part of the empire. But the trees in that third part of the empire were burnt up. All the green grass was burnt up. These people practiced a scorched earth policy. Now, this was not true of every conquering army. Some conquering armies, and we'll see one in the next chapter actually, were careful not to damage the trees. They just had a certain mission that they were on. But these people were practicing a scorched earth policy. policy. Gibbon specifically said that blood and conflagration and the burning of trees and herbage marked their path. I'll read you, since I had the Age of Faith out here, I'll just read you one little description on page 36. So this is volume 4 of Will Durant's 11-volume set, The Story of Civilization. And a little bit about this same period of time, because he adds some detail here. Still talking about 410 AD, with when the Goths had come to Rome. Meanwhile, an incalculable number of barbarian slaves escaping from their Roman masters entered the service of Alaric. And he's talking about on the inside of Rome, a slave opened the gates. The Goths poured in. And for the first time in 800 years, the great city was taken by an enemy, 410. For 3 days, Rome was subjected to a discriminate pillage that left the churches of St. Peter and St. Paul untouched and spared the refugees who sought sanctuary in them. But the Huns and slaves in the army of 40,000 men could not be controlled. Hundreds of rich men were slaughtered, their women raped and killed. It was found almost impossible to bury all the corpses that littered the streets. Thousands of prisoners were taken. He goes on down a little bit further and says, gold and silver were seized wherever found. Works of art were melted down for the precious metals they contained. Many masterpieces of sculpture and pottery were joyously destroyed by former slaves who could not forgive the poverty and toil that had generated this beauty and wealth. Alaric restored discipline and led his troops southward to conquer Sicily. But in that same year, he, Alaric, was stricken with fever and died. This is a kind of a side point about the prominent men involved as conquerors in the book of Revelation. Time after time after time, we'll see if I can remember to tell you. Time after time, when somebody has done the conquering that they providentially needed to do, they died. It's like their job was done and they just died. And we'll see that all the way here from the 5th century clear on up to the 19th century. When they were done with what they were predicted to do, they passed from the earth for one cause or another. It's just an interesting side point that we see happen over and over again. So that same year, when his job was done, Alaric died. And that was the first trumpet, Alaric and the Goths. Questions on the first trumpet? Yes, Kevin.
I might just make a comment on your thoughts very briefly.
All right.
The capital was moved in about 330 or 331, which
yes. Yes.
What was the government like briefly, and how did that help in the fall of Rome at this time?
They still had their own emperor there in the city of Rome. There was another emperor over in Constantinople. So you had a Western emperor and an Eastern emperor, and they vied with one another for power, but neither one was strong enough. None of these people were like what we saw in the days of Trajan and those people, where they held universal sway over a whole empire. In fact, in one quotation that I read, maybe I did read from Gibbon last night or the night before, I've forgotten which it was, but he talked about the emperors of Constantinople being pale imitators of their predecessors, Augustus and Trajan. They were really nothing like that. But they thought they were, or they wanted people to think that they were. So they wore the title of emperor, they wore the imperial purple, they still had all the festivities going on at court, but in their actual power, it was diluted. Now, as we go down through these first four trumpets, which are a unit, we'll see the emperor of the city of Rome actually sending some envoys out to try to negotiate a reconciliation or to buy somebody off, in essence, so that he doesn't even come into the city of Rome. So they had that kind of power to send envoys out. They also sent the bishop of Rome, Leo I, at that time, out to talk with the man who was the leader of the Huns at that time, which we haven't quite gotten to yet. But they were there, and they had power, and we have complete lists of these emperors in both Rome and Constantinople. Good question. You know, the thing that was said there in 2 Thessalonians chapter 9, he that now letteth will let until his power be taken out of the way. I think that's what these emperors were, still maintaining the appearance of having that imperial power, even though it was weakening as time went by here. But they kept the apostasy from burgeoning the way it did after that imperial power was removed. Good question. Yes, Mike?
Just thinking about, you know, the the sixth seal.
Yes.
Where paganism fell, Constantine came into power, and Christianity became the religion of the government and
yes.
the people you talked about last night, and all these people coming to Christianity, and the if I get it right, the politics of the nation or changing towards Christianity, you know, seems to, and then now the destruction after it turned to Christianity seems to be out of character with what we see of, like, the city of Nineveh.
Mm-hmm.
Places where God told to repent, and they repented, and God turned from his wrath.
Yes. Yes, that's an excellent question. And one of the things that we have to say about that is that, unfortunately, by the time that we're talking about, the Christianity was becoming more and more perverse, perverted, and unlike the Christian faith that we read about in the Bible. By this time already, a great deal of apostasy had occurred. And from the time Constantine made it popular to be a Christian, this process was accelerated. When you knew that you were taking your life in your hands to become a Christian, you had to be sincere about it. You had to be willing to pay the price, to count the cost, to become a follower of the Messiah. But once Constantine said, this is now the state religion of the Roman Empire, then suddenly everybody wants to be a Christian because this is how you get the good political appointments, and it really became a lot more perverse a lot quickly. So we're dealing here already with an apostatized form of Christianity already, and it's not to the degree that it would be later, but already true Christianity, as we read about it in the Bible, was beginning to have to go underground, because from Constantine's time he could persecute forms of Christianity that were not according to the orthodoxy of the day as he saw it. I mean, for example, I mentioned that when he wanted to be baptized, he called for a priest. Well, the Bible teaches us, we've already seen in the book of Revelation, and you already well know, that we are a kingdom of priests. Every child of God is a priest and a minister, as the Bible speaks of this. In the Old Testament, that was predicted. In the New Testament, that came to be. But we've already had that clergy-laity split take part. So any conquering of Rome is going to be dealing primarily with an apostatized form of Christianity. That's why when I would talk about, if I was going to put it in writing, I would put that Christian in quotation marks. And I, last night when I said that Constantine was I said he was the first so-called Christian emperor, because I think we need to distinguish that. We don't want to use the word Christian in a way that the New Testament does not use it, and sometimes it's hard to communicate about these things. But these people had yet to be, I think another part of the answer to your very good question is that the long-suffering of God comes into account here. The Romans needed to be paid back. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Rome needed to be paid back for this tenfold persecution that we talked about, and the long-suffering of God had allowed that not to occur yet, but yet, as one old farmer said one time, God doesn't settle all his accounts in October. God hadn't forgotten about it. Just because the long-suffering of God occurs, that doesn't mean God has forgotten, and there is payday someday. I think that's a part of it, too. They made this change. It was largely political, apparently, for a lot of the people who were higher-ups. There was just as much corruption governmentally as there had been under paganism. So it wasn't a true conversion. And I think taking those two parts of that answer, that at least goes part way. Here's an important thing that we need to keep in mind. Anytime you see a state religion, church and state combined, in bed together, as it were, then you know that that church is not the Lord's church. The Lord's church is never combined politically with any kind of a state to form a church-state religion. Anytime you have the Lord's church get too close to government, it always becomes perverse. There seems to be a perversionary power almost in the very process. So when you see church-state religion, you know that that's not the Lord's church that's involved there. The Lord's church is purer than that. The Lord's church puts him first. And when government is almost the converse of that sometimes. Will Durant, in one of his books, I think it was the book about the Reformation, he said men lie most when they govern states. It would really be difficult to hold a high political position and do the things that you were expected and called upon to do there and still adhere to Christian principles. It's hard enough even in local government sometimes. I'm not saying that it can't be done, but it's. I've read a lot of biographies of politicians, presidents, and others. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, who was basically an honest man, but still, just the nature of the beast is that unless you compromise yourself, you're giving a tremendous advantage to your enemies who are willing to compromise themselves. So church-state religion always becomes perversionary for the church, and it turns to the place where the candlestick is surely taken away and it's not the Lord's church anymore. So this isn't really happening to the Lord's church. It's happening to a group of people who are claiming to be Christianized and do claim Jesus as their leader, but for the most part are not living as though Jesus is their leader. Appreciate the question. I think your question is better than my answer, but those two prongs go partway in answering it, perhaps. Other questions or thoughts?
Any historical significance to the half an hour silence?
When he says about a half an hour, that makes me think it's just an indefinite delay. We saw that the final great wave of persecution was ended about 311 A.D. And yet, this that we're looking at here does not happen until the beginning of the 5th century. We have Constantine claiming to be a Christian in the 320s and solidifying his power, and by 330 he has moved the capital of the empire over to Constantinople. But it's another 80 years now before this Gothic invasion. That's what I think he's talking about. It's a brief period of time to solidify the Christian faith within the empire and to let the gospel of Christ be preached so that all who will be saved, all who want to be saved, have an ample opportunity to be saved. There were people being truly converted at this time. God knows who they are and who the people who claim to be converted and weren't are. God's perfectly capable of making the right decision in every case when human eyes really can't. All we know is what God said, and we try to apply that. But basically speaking, you and I stay on the love seat and let God stay on the judgment seat, and he'll handle all that. But I think this delay was to allow these forces to become solidified, to have as many people as could come to the faith and get this marking. That's why we have that chapter of marking in chapter 7. Appreciate that. Kevin? Okay. The fact that he says about a half hour, I think, makes it a little more indefinite than it otherwise would be. Now, in the next chapter, we have an hour mentioned, which I think has a specific meaning. But when he says about a half hour, that makes me think that it's just an indefinite period of time and is intended in that way. If it wasn't indefinite, I don't think he would have said about. That's probably the best I can do with that. Good questions. Often your questions are better than my answers, and there's no surprise in that. Other thoughts here? All right, let's go on to the second one. Verse 8 and 9. The second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. Now this is all the same part. Every third part that's mentioned here is all the same part of the empire, the western part of the empire. One time we were studying this and we looked through the four trumpets and they saw that a third part was involved in each one of these four trumpets, and they said, well, that makes four-thirds. That's more than 100%. How can that be? So we need to be aware that each third part here is all the same part. Here we have something about the sea. Verse 7, was the first trumpet was about the earth. Now this one is about the sea, a great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea. Now wherever we have a great mountain, that refers to a kingdom in symbolic language. Last night we turned back to the 49th chapter of the book of Jeremiah and just read a couple of verses there. I think right now I'll turn to the 51st chapter of the book of Jeremiah and just read verses 24 and 25 to remind us of how the word mountain is used symbolically in the Old Testament before we ever get to Revelation. Here he's talking about Babylon, Jeremiah 51, verse 24. I will render unto Babylon and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea all their evil that they have done in Zion in your sight, saith the Lord. Behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain. Now he's talking about Babylon, a nation, but he calls them a mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyest all the earth, and I will stretch out mine hand upon thee and roll thee down from the rocks, and I will make thee a burnt mountain. So that's just a showing in the Old Testament of how the word mountain was used. It's even used of the Lord's nation. The mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it, is said in the second chapter of the book of Isaiah. So a mountain is a kingdom. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to read from Gibbon a little bit again. I hope it's not too tiresome to hear these readings. I just want you to see that a secular historian gives the fulfillment of these prophecies. And by the way, I think this second trumpet is referring to a man by the name of Genseric and the nation that he led that were called the Vandals. Genseric and the Vandals. Gibbon, volume 2, page 231. The death of Gonderic, he was the Vandal king, served only to forward and animate the bold enterprise. In the room of a prince not conspicuous for any superior powers of the body or mind, they acquired his bastard brother, the terrible Genseric, a name which in the destruction of the Roman Empire has reserved an equal rank with the names of Alaric and Attila. We haven't gotten to Attila yet, but he'll come next. Further down, the ambition of Genseric was without bounds and without scruples, and the warrior could dexterously employ the dark engines of policy to solicit the allies who might be useful to his success, or to scatter among his enemies the seeds of hatred and contention. Almost in the moment of his departure, he was informed that Hermanric, the king of the Suevi, had presumed to ravage the Spanish territories which he was resolved to abandon. Impatient of the insult, Genseric pursued the hasty retreat of the Suevi as far as Merida, precipitated the king and his army into the river Anus, and calmly returned to the seashore to embark his victorious troops. The vessels, now remember, we're reading about a trumpet that has to do with the sea. The vessels which transported the Vandals over the modern Straits of Gibraltar, a channel only 12 miles in breadth, were furnished by the Spaniards who anxiously awaited their departure, and by the African general who had implored their formidable assistance. So the first trumpet has to do with the earth and the land and the decimation of that. This has to do with the sea coming into Rome from another direction, from the opposite direction that the others have come in from. We'll go a little bit further with this on over to page 299 of the same book and get just a little bit more information. Trying to cut down as much of this as I can, but I want you to get the flavor and the tone of this if possible. The discovery and conquest of the black nations that might dwell beneath the torrid zone could not tempt the rational ambition of Genseric, but he cast his eyes toward the sea, and he resolved to create a naval power. And his bold resolution was executed with steady and active perseverance. The woods of Mount Atlas afforded an inexhaustible nursery. Now we're on page 300. An inexhaustible nursery of timber. His new subjects were skilled in the arts of navigation and shipbuilding. He animated his daring Vandals to embrace a mode of warfare which would render every maritime country accessible to their arms. And then he goes on and gives a long list of the places that he dealt with and talks about the things that they were doing. And I could read more there, but maybe that's enough and maybe it's too much. The main point here is that Genseric is on the sea. Now, in context, for 600 years, No ship hostile to Rome has successfully disputed the mastery of the sea. In 63 BC, Pompey the Great went out into the Mediterranean Sea and cleared all the pirates out of it in the name of the Roman Empire. He not only took over 12 provinces of land, one of them was Judea. And you know the story of Pompey in Judea, how he went into the temple and all of that. But he also cleaned up the Mediterranean Sea. The Romans were unrivaled on the sea for hundreds of years. But now they have somebody on the sea that they can't deal with. It's Genseric and the Vandals. And the Vandals come up to the city of Rome and they seize it. In the 45 years since the Gothic invasion, by the way, this I've got the Vandals here in second place. This starts in 422 and continues to the year 455, but its start is early here in 422, and that's why we've got it second. But by the time they are really doing what they're doing in Rome here, it's been 45 years since the Gothic invasion, and during that time, much of the pomp and the luxury has in some measure been restored to the city of Rome, and 45 years is a long time. So now the Vandals enter in there, and you know what a Vandal is in our language. The Vandals, our word Vandal today, is taken from the 2 weeks of vandalization of Rome by the Vandals, by the original Vandals, these people. This is a good place to stop and ask, what was it that happened to the golden vessels of the Jerusalem temple? All of us are well familiar with the making of the golden vessels and how prized they were by the Hebrew people. And we know they were used for a long time in the temple of Jerusalem. And we know we can kind of trace historically what became of them. They were taken, first of all, well, you tell me, who took the golden vessels out of the temple? Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, took the golden vessels over to Babylon and put them in one of the temples of Babylon there. What was one of the uses that was made of them while they were in Babylon? Yes. Yeah, I see somebody drinking back there. Yes. The grandson of Nebuchadnezzar by the name of Belshazzar was drinking from them on the very night that Babylon fell in a great drunken feast that he was having in the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel. And so then the Persians had them when they took over from the Babylonians. What did the Persians do with them? Eventually, Cyrus sent them back. Cyrus not only facilitated the reconstruction of the temple in the days of Zerubbabel, but he also sent back these golden vessels to Jerusalem. And then they were used in Zerubbabel's temple, and they were also used later in Herod's. When Zerubbabel's temple was completely remodeled and became Herod's temple, these golden vessels continued to be used then. What happened to them next? They were taken again, this time by the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire destroyed the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, these golden vessels, at least some of the golden furniture and vessels were taken to Rome again. And we know that because on the Arch of Titus that stands in stone in the city of Rome today, right in that stone, in bas-relief in the stone, are depicted the golden candlestick and the golden table of showbread and other booty that was taken from the Jewish temple. When Titus left there, he brought these and used them as symbols of his victory in his triumph in Rome at the time that that great Arch of Triumph of Titus was built. You can go and see in Rome today on that Arch of Titus the depiction of the land. Of course, it's easier just to put it into a search engine and see it on your screen in the comfort of your own home. The internet, there are a lot of bad things about the internet, but there are some really good things about it too. And it has been a great equalizer of information. You used to have books, but now everybody's got all this stuff right at their fingertips, and it's a very, very good thing. That's the internet at its best. You can go home and look at that tonight if you want to and see clearly the menorah, the golden lampstand or candlestick there in bas relief on the Arch of Titus at Rome. Now, I'd like to read a little bit about this from the pen of Edward Gibbon. I'll turn over a page here to page 303 of the same book I've been reading from. The holy instruments of the Jewish worship, the gold table and the gold candlestick with seven branches, originally framed according to the particular instructions of God himself, and which were placed in the sanctuary of his temple, had been ostentatiously displayed to the Roman people in the triumph of Titus. They were afterward deposited in the Temple of Peace, and at the end of 400 years, the spoils of Jerusalem were transferred from Rome to Carthage by a barbarian. It was the Vandals who took these golden vessels then out of the city of Rome at this time that we're talking about, the year 455 B.C. And really, this is the place, as far as I know, where they disappear from history. There's a footnote in Gibbon that talks on the next page, this is page 304 in a footnote, that talks about a shipwreck. At least one of the vessels that was taking all this booty out of the city of Rome, to taking it away, the Vandals taking it away, and to take it down across the Mediterranean to Carthage in Africa. One of those, at least one of those, sank. Now, Gibbon seems to indicate that it would not be the one that was bearing these golden vessels, but I don't know about that. I don't know how much we know about that. One way or the other, it seems that these golden vessels that from ancient times that have all this history now disappear in 455 A.D. And I personally don't really know what happened to the golden vessels after that. I'm not sure that anybody else does. They may have sunk to the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. And if they did, it would be interesting to know what salt water does to gold. I don't know. I mean, yes, do you know? Oh, that's an excellent question, and it was considerably shorter than it is in our present time. I don't know precisely what it was, but I think at that time, if you could reach the 70 that the Bible talks about, you were considered a very old man and considered to have had more than the average life. Excellent question. Thank you. It would depend also, to a certain extent, on what strata of society you were in. Slaves and poor people tended, in general, to die sooner. That wasn't always the case. An equalizer to that was that the patricians, the upper class of the day, ate out of lead vessels as a matter of habit, not knowing what the lead was doing to their bodies. And we've lately dug up some bones of patricians and found that they had a very high content of lead, which isn't good for anybody, whereas the poor ate out of wooden vessels ordinarily, so they were protected. And so that was sort of an equalizer. But in general, those who were cared for by slaves lived longer than the slaves themselves. But all in all, people, we've seen during our lifetime, if you've got any age on you at all, we've seen medicine and health care contribute to the elongation of our lives in this country. When I was a boy, when somebody reached the age of 90, that was quite an achievement. There were very few people reaching it. When they did, you celebrated it and remembered it, and everybody oohed and aahed. Well, today, I know scores of people well into their 90s. You know some of them. We all know our sister over in Nixa, I should have her here to remind me of what her name is. Because she's able to think through things better than I am sometimes. Yes, Rhema. It's a remarkable thing at the age of 97, the way she's able to function. And she's not alone in this. I know one lady even over 100 who's doing pretty well. And a few years ago, that would have been a lot more remarkable than it is now. So it has a lot to do with sanitation and wholesome food, these types of things. Human lifespans can vary quite a lot from time to time and from one group of people to another. But back then, it was not what it is now. Yes?
Is it reported that the sea became blood anywhere?
The idea of the sea becoming blood, I think, is that the Vandals were coming across the water, and the idea is that their battles were primarily naval, and that the blood in the water would symbolically be referred to.
Were they coming from northern Africa?
Yes, they certainly were. The Goths came from the north, and the Vandals came from the south. So we read about those four winds, and we've got winds coming from various directions here. Excellent. Thank you. Yes?
I looked up what salt water does to gold, and it doesn't
Good.
Do anything to
Good.
It. The barnacles that would like to stick on it was building so softly.
I see. Well, I don't know if these golden vessels are at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea or not, but if we can find the Titanic in the depths of the ocean, I would think that now we're technologically capable of taking a look. So that would be fascinating, though. I rather suspect that they did make it to Carthage and were melted down for the metal, just chopped up and melted down. That's what I'm thinking probably happened, but we don't know.
Go ahead. While you're on the subject there, the Ark of the Covenant, though,
Oh, it was gone. It was long gone. Yes. It was gone in the days of Jeremiah and the Babylonians. It's thought by many people that Jeremiah took the Ark of the Covenant to save it from the Babylonians and may have hidden it in a cave on the way down to Egypt. Remember, he went down, was taken down there. But we don't know what became of it, and it's probably just as well. It may be that the Lord providentially arranged for it to disappear so that it wouldn't become a snare of idolatry to the people. I don't know about that, but we haven't known about it since 600 years before Christ. In Zerubbabel's temple and again in Herod's temple, the most holy place was completely empty so far as the Ark of the Covenant was concerned. Neither one of them ever had the Ark of the Covenant. They couldn't make another one because it was made by inspired men. Bezalel and Aholiab were inspired by God to make it the way God wanted it, and there was nobody else ever inspired to make one to replace it. I thought there was another hand moving, but okay, Kevin, over here.
You got 33 years there, from 422 to 455.
Yes.
They were fighting the Romans, basically.
Yes.
30 years or so, this was on the sea, is that right?
Yes.
And only the last year or two, the last few months,
right,
they actually came to Rome.
Right. They were maritime, and primarily what they were doing was turning this third part of the sea in symbolically into red with the blood that they were spilling.
That
yes.
They actually did invade the city.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they not only invaded the city, but they sacked it for two solid weeks. And they stripped metal off of the buildings and just did everything that vandals do today and more. Good question. And I guess that's, fortunately, I looked at the clock at a better time than I do sometimes. I guess we need to leave it right there. Tomorrow night we'll begin with a man that I think everybody has heard of. But we'll leave his name. If you come back tomorrow night, we'll, Lord willing, we'll try to refer to him then.
Is there good historical reference to the vandalism? That
yes. Yes.
Given?
Yes. Actually, I read that, but it was very quick, and I know that when somebody is reading these things, it's hard to really get that. Let me look and see what page that was on just quickly. I think I've got so many pages turned down here.
That's all